Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner, and good to have you here on the Mark Steiner Show. Look forward to joining us for this conversation at 410-319-8888. You can email us to talk@steinershow.org. We are about to have a conversation looking at what Brexit means and why it occurred and where it takes us and the complexities of all that. We are joined right now by Maria Margaronis, who welcome. Good morning. How are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
I'm very well. Contributing editor to The Nation, based in the London Bureau. Good to have you with us, Maria. Here in the studio, Dr. Steven Isberg. Steve Isberg is Associate Professor of Finance at the Merrick School of Business at the University of Baltimore. And I think we'll soon be joined by Neil Davidson, who is also be joining us from Glasgow, where he's is the author of The Origins of Scottish Nationhood and another thinker on a different side, from the left, but a different side on what Brexit means. So good to have you all with us.
Great to be here.
Thank you.
So, Mara, this is so we've all been watching the news, obviously, about what's been but what's been happening in with Brexit. But just all, in some ways, the things we've seen recently. Just a quick update from you. It sounds really confusing. We've been reading about all these things that this is not a binding vote, so they don't have to do it. The Scottish Parliament could say no, we're not going to approve it, which means it won't happen. Could you sort some of this out for us?
I can try. Nobody knows what's happening, really. Let's just start with that. This is the most convulsive event in British politics.
Yes.
You know, certainly in my lifetime, and probably you know, for many years before that too. So just to put the Scottish Parliament thing to rest, there has been one legal theory that the Scottish Parliament has to approve it for it to go ahead, but then that's been argued against by others. So I actually don't think that's the case. In terms of what may happen next, I mean, a lot of people are panicking about Brexit, including some leaders of the Leave campaign, like Boris Johnson. He's suddenly gone, oh, whoops, well, no, we don't have to do it right away, because nobody knows what it's going to mean, and nobody knew what it was going to mean. And this has been a really good example of what people call post-factual politics, which your very own Donald Trump is so good at, where you tell people what you think they want to hear, but you have, in fact, some quite different agenda up your sleeve. Which in the case of the Leave campaign was you tell people, you know, we're going to basically dial Britain back to the golden age of the knot of the 1950s, and all the immigrants will vanish as if by the wave of a magic wand. And I'm rambling on. But
No, you're fine. You're not rambling at all. You're making a lot of sense.
Nobody knows what's going to happen next in British politics. Both main political parties are in absolute turmoil. 24 members of Jeremy Corbyn's Labour shadow cabinet have now quit. And so there's going to be a Labour leadership election sooner or later, probably sooner. David Cameron has said he's resigned. So both parties are in a very intense fight, which is not just about the leadership, but about the identity of the parties. Both major parties have, in effect, been coalitions for a long time. The Tory party has been a coalition between, among other things, pro-Europeans and anti-Europeans, which is why this whole fiasco happened in the first place, because David Cameron had promised to hold a referendum, really to sort out the division in his own party and to fight off UKIP, the UK Independence Party, which was barking at his heels from the right. And the Labour Party has been in a very deep fight also for a long time between the supporters of Tony Blair, the old Blairites, the left of the party, represented by Jeremy Corbyn, and another sort of less known group known as Blue Labour, which was a group really trying to appeal to those working class communities who've been shut out and left behind since Thatcher, since Blair, whose jobs have been gutted, who are the people, in fact, who voted massively to leave. So that's sort of where we are. It's exposed a very, very deep split in Britain between the haves and have-nots.
And I know we're also joined here by Neil Davidson before we turn to Steve Isberg. Neil, welcome. Good to have you with us as well.
Hi.
And I was hearing on the way in this morning that Farage, is how you say his last name? Nigel Farage?
Yes.
Yeah. So he was just being interviewed by a British broadcaster because he apparently during the campaign was saying that this money saved from what we pay the EU every month every year will now go to shoring up the healthcare system, and he's backed away from that commitment, as of others, which is one of the reasons some people argue that many people didn't vote for it because they wanted more money in the national healthcare system, which was one argument I just heard this morning. But, Neil, let me get your perspective on that.
Yeah, Farage lied through the campaign, particularly about issues like money. So this is all come to roost because they're giving way on all the things they'd said. I mean, I agree with a lot of what Maria said in her contribution there about the kind of thinking on the Leave camp. I think it's important to say, though, why the Tory party has been so divided on this question for so long. It's not just because some people are mad Little Englanders. It's actually because of the problems of neoliberalism and the fact that it hasn't actually resolved Britain's economic problems. And so what you actually got was a kind of the beginnings of an alternative strategy for British capitalism emerging from Michael Gove, not so much from Boris Johnson. I don't think is capable of that. But certainly there are some thinkers who are trying to see a way of could Britain align itself more with the United States, make a tilt towards Asia and break away from Europe in order to do that. But in order to get any kind of popular support for that, they had to whip up a great deal of xenophobia and racism in order to try and get popular basis for a vote, which, again, as Maria said, I don't think they actually expected to win. And now they haven't the faintest idea what they're going to do. I mean, it's not just that they don't have a plan B, they don't have a plan A. This is why they're prolonging the thing as much as possible. But of course, the EU is in no humour to actually delay things for Britain or to make an easy exit. I mean, they want to make it clear to the other members, the other 27 states, that leaving the EU is not an option you get is pain-free. So they've no incentive to be nice to Britain. Angela Merkel has, because Germany actually trades quite significantly with Britain, but the Commission has not. And so I think they're going to play a hardball here. So the situation is very difficult for the British political elite, the British ruling class, in the sense that they're in a situation which the leading party of British capitalism, the Tory party, is now in a situation of being about to implement a policy which is opposed by most of British big business, which is an unheard of situation. I mean, this, in a sense, is a self-inflicted disaster that's probably the greatest one since Suez, and maybe even before then. I mean, so they are not in a happy situation. On the other hand, it has whipped up a great deal of racist violence, and already migrants being attacked in the street, or people who are identified as migrants, which is always going to be a kind of outcome of this. I don't think it's true that everybody who voted for Leave is simply a racist xenophobe. I think there are people who are bear in mind what happened to Greece earlier this year and last year at the hands of the EU and see that as being part of what the EU's about. So it's not entirely a racist thing or something that's just whipped up by people who are idiots in declining industrial areas who don't know what their own interests are. There's a lot of very complex things going on here. But certainly, there's a lot of stuff that's not very pretty, and I think that it's certainly incumbent on the left now to mobilise in support of migrants in this country, whatever their views were on whether we should stay or leave. I think that's the most urgent task for them. But whatever is going to happen, there'll be a deep instability now in British politics for the next 2 years, not least in Scotland, where it is perfectly true that I don't think there can be a legal challenge to the outcome of the referendum on the basis that Scotland voted differently. But it certainly has already pushed large numbers of people towards the possibility of voting for independence in another India ref.
Another referendum.
Yeah, yeah. So the referendum in 2014 was lost 45-55. But that already, loads of people, including people who are strong supporters for not leaving the UK, have already publicly come out and said, well, because of this, I would now be in favour of voting for independence. So it's quite possible that David Cameron is going to be the Prime Minister who actually brought an end to the United Kingdom in a slightly longer term by doing this. From his point of view, I think, badly misjudged referendum. I mean, he didn't have to hold it in the same way he didn't have to hold the Scottish referendum in quite the way he did. So that's two great strategic blunders he's made. So, right. You know, so the situation is very, very unstable, and it'd be foolish to predict, I think, anything in the short term.
Steve Isberg.
Kind of reminded me of the movie from the 1970s, the candidate, Robert Redford, the unlikely senator, gets elected, looks at his campaign manager, says, so what do we do now? You know, there's an interesting dynamic here. There's a reality that people are responding to, and that reality is that for the last 40 years, the global economy has been restructuring, and income has been redistributed. And it's been redistributed in favor of a particular group at the expense of large groups of, you know, what were known as middle class people. And this has been the long run cost of this divided economy. That's the reality. The deception that we've seen is, well, blame it on the immigrants. You know, you go back to 1900, the early 1900s, when there was the same kind of move in the economy. And income was being redistributed, and, you know, rich were getting richer, and the poor working class were getting poorer. Politically, what happened? They blamed it on the immigrants. You know, you see that time and time and time and again. And as you pointed out before the show, you know, what the political forces are doing is taking advantage of an underlying theme of racism, you know, the racist feelings. And it's real easy to get people's blood up with that emotional aspect of the issue when they clearly don't understand what's going on economically. So, you know, what you're seeing here is an extremely disruptive response to a long-term restructuring that's been taking place, again, for close to 40 years now. And I'm just wondering if this isn't any more than a preview of coming attractions for what we can expect in November here. You know, Trump's numbers in the polls don't appear to be as good as they were a few months ago, but the pollsters were wrong in England. And, you know, who's going to show up to vote in November? And what does this mean for the U.S.? And could we see the same thing? And then could this end up being more widespread when you look over the landscape of Europe? You know, France, Austria, Germany, could similar movements start to undermine, you know, the established economy and the established political economy the way it is here in the U.K.?
So I think, Maria, part of this is the complex situation here is that the lines are not as easily drawn as they used to be.
The lines are certainly not easily drawn, and I agree with Neil that the Leave vote is a complex phenomenon. And you know, those of us down here in the metropolitan South who are saying, "Oh, it's, you know, it's a racist vote," it's not. It's not just. It's a vote against elites. It's a vote. It's a sort of FU, you know, from people who feel completely disenfranchised against the people who they feel have disenfranchised them. But what I think we're going to be looking at ahead, and where we really have to think carefully, is what will happen when people who voted for Brexit, hoping that it would fix things for them, find that it really doesn't. And that's where I think people on the left have to, you know, we really have to think about how to come up with a response to the situation people are in, which we've so far failed to do. And this is partly why this has happened. Globalization is not something that left parties either in Europe or in the United States have had a convincing response to.
And I think because the situation in terms of international economics is, as I was trying to get to a moment ago, I think what you were just saying, Maria, is hugely complex and different than it ever was. I mean, part of the reason the EU even began, and maybe I'll be challenged with this, but this is what my reading of history is, that this is the beginning of the free flow of capital. Allow that to become unencumbered, and in the meantime, part of that opening up also allowed people to move between borders without passports and get more freedom of movement, especially to a creative class and to older people retiring and young people wanted to move and see Europe and experiment different ways of living. I mean, so it did a couple of things, but I think that's one of the reasons why it's so murky, because it's an opening, but at the same time it shuts down what happens in individual countries' ability to grow and take care of its citizens. And that's the contradiction. And so the question is, and that contradiction has led to Brexit. It's led to Donald Trump in America. It led to a right-wing fascist almost winning in Austria. I mean, that's...
Well, but the other part of this is that neoliberalism and austerity politics have led to these things too, which are not necessary corollaries of a free movement of capital, and certainly not of the free movement of people.
And Steve, before I turn back to Neil, Steve, why don't you jump in and then go right back to Neil?
Well, what's interesting about your comment about how this is essentially was an attempt to liberalize the movement of capital and trade, if you take a look at the impact that the euro has had as a currency since the mid-90s, and in a way what that has done is masked, prevented the market from properly allocating capital in a way that responds to risk and return. Just take a look at Greece and Portugal and the European countries who, you know, because they had access to euros through the European Central Bank, were able to overborrow. And had you not tried to integrate that economy with a single currency, you know, the valuation on those bonds might have been a lot different early on. And that risk may have been more properly identified in the market, and the collapse that they experienced might not have been allowed to happen because not as much capital would have moved into that area. So, you know, when you try to create an environment in which capital's moving freely, and then you inhibit it and structure it with all these regulations, you're going to run into problems. So really, it's an essential flaw in the design of the system to a degree, too, and this is what people are responding to.
Neil?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's important to understand that the EU has changed quite a lot over its history. I mean, when it originally emerged, the EEC and so on in the 50s and 60s, it was pretty much dominated by the same kind of Keynesian social democratic kind of consensus that most individual countries in Western Europe were dominated by at that time. It's really during the 80s that it begins to respond to the shift to neoliberal globalization by becoming a kind of mechanism for enforcing rules. I mean, there's actually a very interesting article by Friedrich von Hayek from 1939 called, I think, The Economic Conditions of Interstate Federalism, where he says, what we need is an institution that is run by an unelected bureaucracy, so it isn't influenced by voters, and secondly, is run on a series of rules which impose certain policies on governments so that they can't get out of it, and it imposes the market order effectively. Now, that in a way is what you've got in the shape of the Commission on the one hand, and in shape of its various edicts on the other. And this is since the 80s, certainly since the 90s, and the establishment of the Maastricht Convergence Criteria has been what's been imposed on the states within the Eurozone. Now, clearly it doesn't affect Britain because it's stayed outside, but it does mean that the structure of power within Europe, particularly with Germany very much at the top and France now some way beneath Germany in that structure, is simply imposed. So the weak countries like Greece, like Spain, like Portugal, like Iceland and so on, are made to subscribe to these rules, whereas the more powerful countries like Germany and France can actually avoid them where they like and have done in the past. So there's a lot of rhetoric about Europe, which is at the level of quite vague feelings of, you know, we want to be European and cosmopolitan and so on. But that's nothing to do with the EU as an institution, which is quite different. And the way it's been behaving, I think, is essentially to establish a so-called level playing field, which is impossible given the different size and power and productivity of the different countries that are involved with the structure. If it had stayed as a common market, then it might have been able, I think, to survive. But the introduction of the Eurozone and the Euro meant that you have all of the disadvantages of that without having any of the advantages of a state. In other words, you know, you can't transfer money from Germany directly to Greece, you only lend it. Whereas if Greece was simply a region of a broader Europe, you'd be able to transfer money in the way you can within an individual country. But you can't do that. So I don't think it's sustainable in the long term. And I mean, one of the things the British exit might have done is actually expose the overall weakness of the whole structure. You know, they either go back to some kind of earlier model, which is simply a free trade zone with some free movement within it, or move forward to, you know, the ever closer union with which the treaty speaks. But I don't think that's going to be possible now. A lot of other people will simply say, Britain has managed to do this and escape. We don't want to get out, but we want to impose more conditions, special conditions for us, and will allow us to stay in as a kind of price of staying in. So I think the structure is going to be badly weakened from now on. And I think it's important to establish Europe, insofar as there are European values and so on, freedom and all the rest of it, that we accept that these are nothing to do with the EU, which actually rejects them, and certainly outside its own borders all the time, as you can see in the way it's treated the refugees from Syria, and so I'm trying to get into it at the moment.
Go ahead, Maria, I hear you, go ahead.
Well, you know, I agree with that. My family come from Greece. I've spent much of the last 5 years covering the crisis in Greece, and I've seen how EU policies have gutted not only the economy and society, but also Greek politics. I mean, Greek politics has unraveled. You can't really say that there's a democracy there anymore. But the sort of soft unraveling that Neil is describing is, I think, the good scenario. What I'm worried about is an unraveling, a right-wing unraveling, because as we've seen, you know, the Brexit campaign here was led by the right and gave a lot of comfort to the far right, who now have a much stronger voice in British politics than they had before. And we're seeing the rise of, you know, Marine Le Pen in France from the Front National was thrilled by it. In Greece, Golden Dawn were thrilled by it, the neo-Nazi party. So this is where I think very, very careful thinking is needed to make sure that whatever happens next, it doesn't feed those right-wing forces across the continent.
Yes, I agree with that. I mean, I think that entirely a lot of what happens now depends on what the left actually does. And I think that whatever happens, you have to be able to move independently of the European Union. I think one of the biggest weaknesses of attempts to the left-remain argument, if you like, in Britain, was essentially to say that the only hope we have is the EU. It's the only thing that preserves workers' rights. It's the only thing that preserves environmental protections and so on, which has never been true. But to say that virtually disarms people, because then now that we're in this situation, what can we do? We're helpless. The EU, you know, can't help us. I mean, you've got to, in a sense, say that the only hope for people is their own organisation and solidarity across borders outwith the structures of the European Union. I agree and share your concerns about the rise of the far right, but that's happening outside of the European Union as well, as Trump has already been mentioned, of course, in the Tea Party and so on in the States. That's not caused by the EU. It's caused by a kind of populist response to the problems that neoliberalism has caused for most working class people and for the lower sections of the middle classes. So this is a general problem, I think, even outside of the EU, which the left has to respond to. And in a way, I suppose the Bernie Sanders campaign in the States was a reaction to it in that country. The trouble is we haven't seen anything comparable in Britain yet. But Podemos and so on in Spain is a left alternative to these kind of issues. The trouble is the right hasn't been the running, I think, to date.
And to me, it seems in many ways, and I said this in some other programs, looking at some other issues we face here in the States and around the world. I mean, it feels in some ways, I hate to be negative here towards the end of this conversation, as negative, but like a great unraveling, Steve. Feels like it's...
Well, it is. It's kind of like two tectonic plates that have been working against each other but not moving, and now that energy is built up, and they start moving, and you have a 9.2 on the Richter scale. I think the important thing for us all is going to be watch what happens to the money. I think in Britain's favor right now, they never left the pound. They have their own currency. And, of course, Rothschild said, let me issue and control the supply of a nation's currency, and I care not who writes the laws. Be very, very, very alert to what happens to the euro, because the euro right now is the key to holding the EU together. If you see the euro start to unravel, you're going to see the EU unravel very quickly. The pound has taken a beating. The euro's not looking that much better. It's with the loss of a key major stable trading partner, that's going to add a lot of instability to the EU, that market for that underlying currency is unstable, and what happens there is going to be a real a good sign of what might come politically.
So we have to take a break here for the news, and I really wanted to get your thoughts on a very quick analytical thoughts on where you think this all goes from here, your fresh analytical balls, if you might. Do you all have like 5 minutes to wait till after the news break to can come back and give us a quick closing?
Sure. The studio I'm in is, I think, booked at 4, so I'm afraid I don't.
Okay, well, that's right. We'll do this. We'll do this later on in the week, in another day soon.
Okay.
And we really want to have you back. And sorry the ISDN didn't work. Glad to have you on the phone with us here. It's been wonderful to have you with us.
Thank you so much. Pleasure to talk to you all.
Maria Maragonis, of course, is contributing editor of The Nation, based in London and at their London Bureau. Dr. Steve Isberg, Associate Professor of Finance at the Merrick School of Business at the University of Baltimore. Neil Davidson teaches at the University of Strathclyde. Did I say that right?
No, it's actually Glasgow I teach at, University of Glasgow.
Glasgow, sorry, University of Glasgow. I did say that one right. Author of The Origins of Scottish Nationhood. And Neil, we deeply look forward to you coming back soon as well. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
We'll be right back, and when we do, we jump into Baltimore, Port Covington, Brace, and more.